Hey there, listeners. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. We're going to be hosting a live seminar. It's going to be held by video on June 19th. That's Wednesday, June 19th. It'll be 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be 90 minutes. This first seminar is hosted by Amgen. We're going to have three different team members with three different roles, with three different backgrounds, all veterans on the live panel. And just like on the show, I'm going to do 45 minutes of Q&A with the three of them. And then we're going to take 45 minutes and open it up to the audience to answer any and all questions that you have. If you have any interest whatsoever in about Amgen, about the biotech and medical services industry, about functional roles that are universal across every industry, I'd really encourage you to join. I would love to see you there, add some faces to some names, and have your participation. I think you're going to learn a lot, and we're very, very excited to kick this off. And also very grateful for Amgen's support, because by sponsoring this panel, they're helping us expand our work over here at Beyond the Uniform. And all of this is 100% free for you to join. So costs nothing. You can register through our newsletter, or look for a link on the site. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to challenge and support the members of the military community to succeed in their post-service civilian career. Today's episode number 272 with Morgan Plummer.
I think the greatest danger that we face is the certainty that we're going to know what the future will look like. Which is to say, like, we can talk about game-changing fifth-generation technologies, and there are those out there for sure, right? Hypersonics, ballistic missile defense, quantum computing, all things that could, in their own right, fundamentally change the nature of warfare. I think, though, if you, you know, one of my favorite quotes is from Bob Gates, former Secretary of Defense, right? When he opined at one point that, you know, if you look at the long line of guesses that the United States has made with respect to the future security environment, you know, we've gotten it wrong 100% of the time. And so this idea that you have to build in kind of flexibility into our problem-solving process, into our solution development, I think all of that leads to you have to have a community of problem solvers that looks a lot more heterogeneous than the current one does.
I am very excited to finally get this episode out there. I recorded this episode over about a month ago with Morgan, and was just really, it was one of those conversations that I was like, man, I can't believe I get to do this. I felt like I learned a lot, and am really championing the work that Morgan's doing. I think he's doing great work in the world. Morgan talks about how he made the difficult decision to leave the military after 12 years of service, and how he was pulled into government service afterwards. He talks about his day job, which is with the U.S. Department of Defense, but we spend the bulk of the time talking about the nonprofit version of his day job, the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. I found this organization and Morgan's journey with it extremely compelling. It's a great look at how the military and non-military community can work together to be better than just the sum of their parts. It's also compelling to see how a side pursuit can lead to more passion and productivity in one's life. I've been thinking about this interview for a while now because I really love the alignment that Morgan has found in his life, where both his day job and his hobby of that he does with the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum are both pushing him in the same direction, sharpening his skill set, and, as you'll hear, giving him a tremendous amount of passion, knowledge, and expertise. As always, at beyonduniform.org, you will find over 270 episodes just like this one. You will also find show notes with links to everything we discuss. Special thanks to J.M. Zane, who on Apple Podcasts wrote, "A great forum for discussion of successful, high-performing, transitioning military members." Thank you, J.M. Zane, and all of the 110 people who have left positive reviews on Apple Podcasts. It's very much appreciated. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Morgan. Well, joining me today in Arlington, Virginia is Morgan Plummer. Morgan, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the gracious invitation.
Of course, of course. For listeners, Morgan is the executive director of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, or DEF, which inspires, connects, and empowers people to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. He also works as managing director of the National Security Innovation Network. He started out at Michigan State University, after which he served in the Army for 12 years with multiple U.S. units, and once as an advisor with multiple U.S. Deployments, and once as an advisor to the Iraqi Army. He holds a master's degree in policy management from Georgetown University. So, Morgan, maybe to start things off, it's interesting because you transitioned out of the Army at that 12-year point, which I know for a lot of listeners who are on active duty, that's a frequent question. Could you walk through how you evaluated leaving at that point versus staying to retirement?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think, you know, as with everybody's case, right, each story is individual and kind of has its own aspects and components to it. So I think in my particular case, so I got my degree at Georgetown. And then sort of attendant to that, and I was still wearing the uniform, attendant to that, I went to go do an assignment at the Pentagon, which, you know, like every combat arms officer dreads, right? This, you know, going inside the five-sided puzzle palace. In my particular case, I ended up as a junior military assistant on then Deputy Secretary of Defense Ash Carter's staff. And as part of that, so some of the listeners will remember the days of sequestration, and the department underwent what was called the Strategic Choices and Management Review, terribly called Skimmer, this notion of, you know, what are all the puts and takes that the department would need to make in order to hit sequestration top lines. And Ash, at the time, Deputy Secretary Carter, was leading that effort on behalf of the building. And so I got sort of intimately involved in the preparation for that on a programmatic level, as well as sort of helping to prepare for the legislative part of that in terms of letting the Congress know what the department's sort of initial choices looked like in order to hit sequestration caps. Throughout this process, I became close with a lot of Deputy Secretary Carter's staff and had a couple folks on the who were political appointees at the time come to me and say through this process, hey, look, like, you know, you're super talented. You know, you could definitely continue to serve in uniform. You know, there's an opportunity to be part of this administration, and you've got a natural sort of knack for policy. You know, if you wanted to do this, I feel like there are people inside the building right now who would help you make that transition. Well, and that was a really hard choice for me. You know, and honestly, and Justin, as you've alluded to, it actually had nothing to do in my mind with the financials, and everything to do with, you know, I really loved wearing the uniform. I really loved leading soldiers. I loved being part of close-knit teams. And I didn't think that I was going to find that anywhere outside. And so it really was a tough choice. But at the end of the day, I decided that there were probably going to be opportunities for me to lead as a civilian and make a different set of choices that could help shape the department over time. And I wanted to take advantage of that. So made the decision to hang up the uniform at 12 years in, converted, became a Schedule C appointee as part of the last administration, then sort of climbed the ranks relatively quickly, and then departed, obviously, when the administrations turned over. And then I now have come back into government after a very brief interlude to help lead this office.
That's great. It's so incredible, but rare to be pulled into an opportunity. I feel like most of the people I speak with, right, they're in the situation I was in, which is like, oh my God, there's so many possibilities. What do I do? Yep. And so I think that's fortunate where it was kind of a unexpected timing of, hey, this is actually a compelling opportunity, though a difficult decision to make.
Yeah. That's right. And I just think it's, you know, I mean, just to be honest, and I think this will resonate probably with some of your viewers. I mean, to be totally honest, you know, my last job in the Army, my last actual job in the Army was as a battalion operations officer for an infantry battalion. And, you know, I mean, we were in between deployments. And so we started to do the thing that all units in garrison start to do, which is worry about, you know, who's made their dental appointments and who's, you know, what people's medical profiles look like. And I don't know, just coming back from the department, you know, after the opportunity to see what I'd seen as part of Deputy Secretary at the time, Carter's staff, I was just like, I can't go back to a tactical unit and track people's DRC status, right? Like that just, that doesn't sound like fun to me. Anyway, sorry, I didn't catch you off.
No, I think that's great. And so for listeners, you can imagine there's a lot of directions to go in my conversation with Morgan. And I kind of want to start with the DEF, the Defense Entrepreneur Forum. Yeah. But before we go into that, if you were to run into someone who's a veteran or on active duty and they said, hey, Morgan, what do you do for a living? Yeah. I imagine that's a tough question for you to answer, but how do you typically answer that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So in terms of my day job, do you want me to talk about the death part?
Or great. Yep.
Yeah, so in terms of my day job, I'm a paid employee of the U.S. Department of Defense, but a huge part of my day is also the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. And so in my day job here at the National Security Innovation Network, I'm totally focused on how do we build a pipeline of non-traditional talent? So how do we work better with early stage ventures? How do we work better with academia? How do we work better with people who are, you know, normally the Googles of the world, right? Who are not going to do business with the department for very good reasons. And how do we bridge some of those cultural gaps and actually leverage that talent, sort of time and personalities to sort of leverage into the department's problem-solving capabilities. On the DEF side, it's really interesting. It actually has a lot of crossover. You know, I've told people before, DEF is basically, and I sort of tripped into this, DEF is basically like the nonprofit version of my paid day job, which is to say, like, fundamentally what DEF is trying to do is to build networks amongst communities for whom the most basic common tenet is this idea that defense innovation is a real thing. It's a thing that has to happen, and it's only going to happen if we can break down some of the cultural barriers between the public sector and the private sector, and a world in which we can allow, you know, startup co-founders and veterans to intermingle and interact with present warfighters so that we can try and solve their problems better and differently. And so in a lot of ways, there's just a really beautiful synergy between the two.
That's great. I mean, what you're saying resonates with me so much. I feel like as a country, as well as I imagine on the defense side, the degree to which we can have a broader dialogue, the degree to which we can have more acceptance and communication and collaboration. It's exciting to hear you say that, because it's like, look, no single group is going to solve this problem. Like, we need that expertise across a broad set of very different people. And I can also appreciate how incredibly difficult that must be. It's different languages, it's different vocabularies, different acronyms. So how do you do that? Like, how do you go about forging that bridge?
Yeah, absolutely. So the key word, and it's become a bit of a sort of trite term of art, but it's one that I think resonates with a lot of people, myself included. The simple answer is collision events, right? This idea that you got to put people in the same room discussing common topics, solving a common problem. Like, don't just put people in a room so that they can mix and mingle and, you know, sort of trade business cards, but like, put them in a room to solve a problem. And the relationships that are built and the language barriers that sort of disintegrate in real time, and the better mutual understanding of multiple parties that come from very, very different disparate backgrounds, there's no substitute for just putting people together and kind of forcing them into a problem-solving activity. That's kind of the mantra of DEF. That is definitely the mantra of the National Security Innovation Network. And it really is this notion of like, hey, look, like, we can talk to each other, but this is not going to be fruitful unless we actually try to do something together. You know, sort of translating that notion of collaborative culture into like, hey, can we do some action together? And that changes. It really is a game changer.
That's great. I'm also just highly cognizant of how many listeners aspire to go into the tech space. And it's like, you're at this weird, not weird, but this really compelling intersection of all of these different groups. Where do, you know, let's say that someone's in the military right now and they're thinking of what they're going to do when they get out. What advice do you have for them about considering an opportunity in what I would consider public service, what you're doing, or in technology? Like, what would you say to them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd say that I think the most compelling things that, and I think this is true in my experience in my day job, and certainly true of my experience as the executive director of DEF. I think the most compelling intersection that is true for veterans and the tech space is this notion of passion, right? This catalyzing power of passion and mission, sense of mission, right? And this is true for startups too, right? I mean, the startup literature is rife with these very small teams of dedicated people who are, you know, eating ramen together and spending 23.5 hours of every cycle together, right? Which actually mirrors in a lot of ways the military experience. And so what I would say is, you know, if you're wearing the uniform and you're even thinking about doing something entrepreneurial, whether it's tech related or not, I think that the blend and the overlap between those two experiences of being in the military and being in the entrepreneurial and tech communities are actually a lot closer than you think they are. And if you're thinking about it, you should give yourself the chance to experience it.
Mm. Do you have any advice for, I'm always curious about blind spots and, yeah. you know, people serving in the military, having worked on both sides,
yep.
what do they need to know about how they might need to change how they operate or how they show up in a meeting or collaborate yeah. that might not land well with someone who's maybe spent their career in Silicon Valley?
Yeah. So it's a good point. So I'll give a super tactical one and I'll give a sort of broader kind of meta one. The super tactical one is avoid jargon. The number one sort of shoot yourself in the foot thing to do. And it's really easy if you spent a career in uniform or a lot of time inside the Beltway is to fall into these jargony acronym based sentences that like, if you were a normal thinking person, you'd like look at on a piece of paper and think like, that's not English, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's a really easy trap to fall into. So I'd say on the tactical thing, just be cognizant of the amount of jargon and the language that you're using. You know, the Department of Defense culture is, and by design, very tribal, but you got to kind of break out of that tribal mentality when you're walking into the startup and the tech communities, because those places are also tend to be pretty tribal. Mm. At the most entrepreneurial level, I'd say there's a big emphasis inside the DoD. There's a big emphasis on team, and that's appropriate. And I think there's a greater tolerance for individual contribution in the tech and the venture communities, entrepreneurial communities. And I think for some people, that's going to be a hard cultural thing to kind of overcome. But I think it's an important thing to overcome, because I think what a lot of the entrepreneurial and startup community gets right is actually finding that right balance between the role of the individual contributor and the role of the team. Whereas in the DoD, sort of the heavy overbearing emphasis is placed on team, often, frankly, at the expense of the individual.
That's so incredible. It's such a different lens on a common problem I've seen in the 260 interviews preceding this one is many people, regardless of their field that come from the military, have a difficult time advocating for themselves in an interview and in the application process. And I hadn't thought of it through that lens of tech background or kind of entrepreneurial background, where it is more of a blend of the team and the individual. And for listeners, I would heavily advise to try to adopt that mindset of it's great, that selfless nature of my team did this, my team did that. That's exceptional. It's a great attribute, but expanding the vocabulary and maybe stretching some muscles to talk about your own contribution, because you do need that blend, like Morgan said, to be successful on the other side.
That's right. That's right.
For listeners who are really excited about the work that you're doing with DEF, how can they get involved? How can they support you?
Yeah, absolutely. So great question. So DEF is, and if you could see my feet, you'd see me stomping three times. DEF is an all-volunteer organization. No one, including myself, is paid. And so honestly, like the only way that DEF survives is when people raise their hand and say, I want to give 5 hours a week. I want to give 10 hours a week. I want to be part of the solution. I don't just want to show up to events. Like I want to help shape those events and craft specific outcomes. And so the very best thing to do is to hit us up on our website, defenseentrepreneurs.org. There's an opportunity there to both sign up for membership, which is always free. There are some opportunities, like if you want to help us out, pay for some events and stuff in our national conference downstream. There's that opportunity, but membership is always free for DEF. We're founded on that bedrock principle. But there are huge opportunities to get involved in local, what we call agoras, after the Roman Forum name, which were basically our local chapters, this notion of idea exchange and sort of breaking down some of those cultural barriers. And then to join also the national leadership team. And that's the immediate team that I lead, which is responsible for shaping all of the programs, all of the services, and then all of the national events that DEF puts together.
What do those national events look like?
Yeah, good question. So we've got a couple different flavors. So the first is our annual conference, which is basically like every annual conference, except it's not. We call it the unconference conference. And it really is predicated on this idea of, and I mentioned it before, sort of focused problem solving. That's typically been the flavor of our conferences. So a lot of breakout sessions, and not breakout sessions to go hear a speaker talk at you, but breakout sessions to say like, hey, here's a real problem from someone inside of our community. Let's put our heads together, because all of us are really different. We all have something to contribute, and try and solve this thing for them, or at least give them like a leg up on the solution. So annual conference, this year's annual conference will be held right here in Washington, D.C. Typically, we hold them kind of throughout the country, but this year we'll be in D.C. In September, final dates TBD, depending on when we figure out the venue. We also have a thing called a DefX, which is a playoff of the TEDx concept. So this notion of like one-day conferences where we bring in really thoughtful people from the defense and the national security innovation space to talk about what they're doing, take members from that particular ecosystem at the regional level and kind of highlight the contributions that they're making. One of the things that we think about a lot inside DEF is like, and I said this at our last annual conference, is, you know, showing people that there's a way to kind of break through the wall and not just bang your head against it. This idea that, you know, like there are people out there in the great wide world who are making serious impact, and highlighting those people at our local regional DEFX, or I should say regional DEFX events. And then finally, we have local drink and things, or Agora meetings. So this is, no kidding, an opportunity that's like kind of part social hour, part sort of like let's all chomp on a big idea, where oftentimes a speaker is brought in who's got something particularly poignant to contribute based off the interest areas of that local Agora. And those are usually held on a monthly basis.
That's great. What I love about that is at least the story that I have is myself, and I think many people who've served on active duty, we love the tactics. We love diving in and getting our hands dirty. Yeah. And what's appealing to me about what you're saying is this is not about abstract theory. This is not about sit down and watch a PowerPoint. This is roll your sleeves up and learn by doing. And what better way? I mean, for me, like I would much rather do that and get to know someone in that way, rather than like having a beer and being in a mixer and wondering who to walk up to. Like, you just learn more about people by seeing how they work, and you learn from them too. So that's a really exciting way to sharpen one's skills and maybe gain some experience outside of what someone did in the military.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, most of our activities or events, right? I mean, they are lots of post-it notes, lots of whiteboard time, lots of drawing, lots of talking stuff through. Very little sort of sit in front of a PowerPoint and just get smarter about a particular topic.
Could you give an example of what one of the problems people were solving in the past, or putting it differently, like what you think one of the big problems that we need to work together to solve today is?
Yeah, so I'm actually going to also address both.
That's great.
In terms of a previous problem, this probably be a best example. And this comes from a couple of years ago. So you may or may not recall when Ash Carter fleeted up from the deputy secretary job to the secretary job, one of his kind of signature set of reforms was the Force of the Future initiative, this notion of sort of fundamentally redesigning talent management. At the time, the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, a guy named Brad Carson, knew of DEF and knew of enough people in DEF that he was like interested in getting a different perspective. And so he turned to DEF and he said, hey, help me think about talent management. Like, you are the force of the future, right? Help me think about this. Like, give me just an outside different perspective. Through numerous workshops and numerous events, including the DEFX, and then parts of an annual conference, the DEF community got together and we had a string of recommendations, which totaled into about 20 some odd pages that went back to the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, supporting the ideas of the Secretary of All Defense to say like, hey, we think we've got something unique to contribute here. And as it turned out, it was submitted to the Secretary as an addendum to the final set of recommendations. And it was called the F5 report. And I always screw up this explanation, but it was like the force of the future by the future force, or something like that, right?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So the F5 report is perhaps the best example and most concrete example, though there have been others. In terms of something that we got to tackle in the future, I think one of the things that increasingly DEF is thinking about is what I'll call the Maven problem, right? This notion that you've got really talented people throughout big tech and the entrepreneurial and the venture communities who have tremendous talent to lend to the national security enterprise, but for very, very good reasons, don't want to be in the business of killing people. And so DEF is one of those unique places as a nonprofit organization where it's like no strings attached, you don't come in with any baggage, where I think you can start to have some of those cultural conversations that I think need to take place in order for eventually those two communities to kind of bridge that gap.
That's so fantastic. I never thought of that aspect. And for my friends in tech, I could see many of them having that sense of like not wanting to be close to the tip of the spear. And so for you to be that neutral third party that's about problem solving, but is not in that threatening way is really exceptional. Because you're right. Like, I think that to be able to tap into the wealth of knowledge and contrasting viewpoints of these people is essential. But that's another nuance of like working with a different group of people is how do you bridge that gap? How do you forge that connection? That's great.
Yeah, that's right. And I think at DAF, we have the ability to provide that nuance in a way that just will, and I say this somewhat tongue in cheek since I'm also employed by the DoD, right? Like in a way that I don't think like the DoD as an entity cannot handle. There's a level of nuance there that's required that I just don't think the DoD can solve by itself.
Yep. What about, and I'm speaking with admiration because you are in that rare set of people where you've got your day job, you've got your side job, and they are perfectly, I mean, I've never met someone where those two things are more perfectly aligned.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, so many listeners aspire to start their own company and it can be difficult to juggle these things. Yep. What advice do you have for people about how you're able to hold both of these without dropping one and how to manage what I'm imagining is a very challenging and time intensive schedule?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think that, you know, at the risk of sounding trite, because I know other folks have offered similar advice. I think the key is always like, you know, like the old adage about, you know, start by paying yourself, right? When talking about on the financial side in terms of savings, you got to make time for yourself. You have to build in and religiously guard time for you, because otherwise, like the other things will just creep in, right? And whether or not time for you, quote unquote, you know, means making sure that you read an hour a day or, you know, for pleasure, or whether or not it means making sure that you do one international trip a year, or whether or not it means you take a vacation a quarter, like whatever that means for the individual, I think if you don't schedule that, and for me personally, I know I have to schedule the time, like I live religiously by my calendar. So if vacation's not on there, it's not happening. You know, you got to put it on there. You got to make the affirmative action to guard that time and then stick by it. I think otherwise it's just too easy to be overcome by life, right? It's just too easy to get caught up in family obligations, other work obligations and volunteer obligations. And I think what I found is like, if you haven't achieved the kind of harmony, work-life harmony, I won't call it balance because there are times they're appropriately, I think, times for imbalance. But if you haven't achieved harmony, then you're no good to anybody.
I think it's such a great piece of advice. And there's that another old adage, but about the glass container and you put the rocks in and then you put the gravel and then the sand and then the water. Yep. And what you're talking about is making those rocks yourself. And the other adage that's overused, but I think it's very true, is the oxygen mask. You have to put it on yourself first. Like, you're not going to be good to anyone. And
that's right.
I mean, experienced burnout in the tech industry, literally like on my calendar here today, I've blocked off an hour where I'm going for a run. It's like, that is I view that as part of my job because I know that makes me overall more productive, more happy, and gives me more energy and resilience. So I think that's a fantastic idea. And I love your thought too about work-life harmony. I think that work-life balance can be misleading. And
that's right.
I like that sense of just kind of finding what harmony looks like for each person, and it's different.
Yeah, no, that's right. And one other thing too, only because I know that, you know, I have a good sense of the demographic of your listeners. I mean, it's important to think of too, I think, guarding, and this is like a paradigm switch. It's important to think of that time of guarding that time for yourself as, and you just used the right phrase, as part of work, right? I know that there are plenty of veterans who would see like an hour of gym time in the middle of the day and view that as like, oh, that's personal time, taking time away from the government, taking time away from, you know, my colleagues or whatever. It's like, no, like if that's what you need to be more productive for the team, then you gotta take that. You gotta take that for yourself and view it as part of your job, not an indulgence.
I'm also realizing that you know, even for listeners who have been out of the military for a while and maybe thinking of a career change, they may view this as a decision tree, whether like, do I go into tech? Or do I go into defense, or do I go into government public service, let's just call it.
Yep.
Do you have, having seen both of these, do you have a sense of kind of pros and cons of each, or why one person might be drawn to one versus another? Or maybe I'm oversimplifying this, but I realize you've got this very unique perspective on this.
Yeah. So I'd say, you know, first at the risk of being cagey, I think, you know, everybody's story is different and, you know, you gotta go where the path leads you. I will say this though. I think that there's value depending on how long you've spent kind of in government and public service. I absolutely believe in the value of doing something different. Because I think a diversity, you know, this notion of intellectual diversity, cognitive diversity, The Department of Defense will be better if you walk away for a small period of time. Like if you're inclined in that direction, you know, to your point of this bifurcated path of sort of tech or ventures or back to public service, go do something different. Go do something that doesn't look like the thing that you just did, because whichever path you choose, the other path will be stronger for it when you decide to sort of gravitate back towards that way. I mean, I will say for my own part, like I took a very small break from government, and frankly, a lot of it had to do with, you know, to your point of burnout, sort of personal reset more than professional reset. But that's the one regret that I have, is that I've been pretty consistent in the public service space. I've had a ton of great opportunity to observe and now directly interact with the tech and the venture and the entrepreneurial space. But doing something different, for me, that is for sure the next step. Because I just want to flavor, I need to mix it up a little bit.
What a great answer. That's so, that was not what I was expecting, but that's, now that you say that, that resonates is so true. Of like that, cause I had thought maybe, you know, I thought maybe you would say, you know, you've got career capital built up in this, so keep sure. That momentum. And I think there's an argument to be made for that. And I can see the richness of getting more data points, getting more information, and getting a different perspective. And even if you go back, you'll be stronger that way. You'll have more to offer rather than just spiking in one particular area. I think that's a really, really wise perspective.
Yeah, thanks. And I think too, you know, I mean, it's, you know, one of the things I've been sort of had the opportunity to see, I think, is that, you know, you watch these folks who kind of pivot, and this is obviously a broad generalization, but you watch these folks who kind of pivot constantly in and out of government. And what you can say, which I think is like no small feat, what you can say is definitely like they know how to be good public servants and they know how to work the system. And that's definitely important. But I think what, and again, I don't want to overstate a general sentiment, but I think what a lot of us are starting to feel a little bit more and more is that like, yeah, the system could use a little bit of disrupting, right? And that probably requires an outside perspective and a diversity of thoughts and opinion that the system is not going to organically bake into itself.
I love that. I have nothing to add. That was beautiful. I wanted to ask about, so you joined the Obama administration as a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness. Could you just share more about what that role looked like? And I'm just always curious, like what it's like to operate at such a high level of any organization.
Yeah. So the kind of meat and potatoes is I started off, Brad Carson, who I mentioned before, he and I, right, like these are always the way these things happen. So his wife, Julie, and I were in Ash Carter's office together when he was the deputy secretary. Her and I became fast friends. She introduced me to her husband. Brad and I became fast friends. And then when I transitioned into the Obama administration, Brad kind of pulled me along with him into the Undersecretary of the Army's office and then into Personnel and Readiness as a senior advisor. So when I started there in Personnel and Readiness, you know, I was somewhere between a kind of a chief of staff and principal deputy. So a lot of it was like just serving as a thought partner and policy advisor to the undersecretary, to Brad, and the principal deputy undersecretary, which was a gal named Laura Junior, super accomplished former DASD of Force Readiness. And so working closely with the two of them, along with our military deputy, we kind of formed the senior leadership of the undersecretariat. So that undersecretariat was $7.2 billion and change in funding, more than 3,200 employees, you know, kind of scattered globally throughout a broad, super broad diversity within the portfolio and in the policy portfolio in terms of like responsibility for DoD schools, responsibility for the DoD healthcare system, responsibility for pensions, responsibility for actuary tables, responsibility for military personnel policy. I mean, it ran the gamut. And I think what was really cool about operating at that level was it forced you really quick to be a generalist and a good generalist, but you had to figure out this ability to dive deep on a particular topic really, really fast, get as smart as you could on it, pull in all the people who were smarter than you on it, and quickly form policy recommendations. It was a great job. I won't say before I took this job, I would say that it's the best job I've ever had. It was amazing. I mean, there's a lot about that time that I miss. But I will also say this, right? And going back to some of my previous comments, Look, when you're operating at that level, you're very much inside the belly of the beast, right? I mean, it's all about how do you get consensus. It's all about, you know, massaging documents to find the least common denominator. And the process, right, when you're operating at that level, you know, the number of people that you need to get quote unquote buy-in from is tremendous, to the point where it's hard, sometimes harder to make, and this is counterintuitive, sometimes harder to make the broad sweeping changes that you would want to make than it would be at maybe a more tactical level where you have a greater immediate span of control or the ability to affect things immediately in your environment, but maybe a smaller span of control.
That's so compelling to think of that, of like, how do you solve problems that have such a diverse group of stakeholders? Like, how do you make something that, I forget my ethics, but it's like, how do you maximize happiness and maximize?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And, you know, I'm curious if you would agree with this, but one thing that jumps out to me is the commonality of what you just said, or what I read into what you just said with people I've talked to in investment banking and consulting, of I see that experience as this crucible experience of just a tremendous amount of work in a very short amount of time, very, very high level, like operating at your peak. Yep. And if you look at that from the work-life balance perspective, I'm imagining your life was very much out of balance. But I think that one of the things that I've seen in these interviews is if you can have an experience like that for a short period of time, you learn 10 times more. You know, yep. You learn 10 times amount of the information in a finite amount of period. And so there's a extreme value, not just to doing that work and at that pace, but rubbing shoulders and sharpening iron with these people who are just operating at their peak. It's very compelling.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I will say there's an Atlantic article that Dave Barno and Nora Bensahill published shortly after Force the Future was launched that directly references inflatable air mattresses springing up in people's office. That was a direct reference to me. I mean, there were definitely some dark days during that period. But as you say, right, like it was absolutely the crucible that I needed to walk through, not just for me, not just to prove myself professionally, but to operate at that level and know that I could operate at that level. And candidly, to get some real work done. I mean, the work that we got done with Force of the Future, the work that we got done with Women in Service, the work that we got done with Transgender Review. I mean, all of those were very, very heavy lifts and had to be done, and deeply painful in terms of, you know, to your point about like life being deeply, deeply out of balance. But now I know what that looks like, and now I know what that feels like, and now I know where the guardrails are in a way that I didn't before. And I think that that's made me better kind of going forward.
And it makes me think of two things you said already. Like one is getting diversity of experience, collecting more data points. And so that experience allowed you to say, okay, what is it like if I operate on this extreme? Okay, good. That's a little bit too far. Now that can inform my next decision. And then the other thing is, I think back to your decision to leave the military. I kind of hear it as like listening to your body, like listening, like when you were describing it, it's like, oh man, I just had this incredible experience and now I'm going back to my day-to-day in the military, and that's no longer what satisfies me. Yep. It's not a reflection on the work. It's not a reflection on anything. It's just at that point in your life, yep, being honest with yourself, that's what you value. And I think that both of those are such great traits for listeners to apply to whatever they do, of just being honest. You know, what appeals to you, what appealed to my 20-year-old self was working 140 hours a week at a startup. I would never do that, but I had that experience that informed who I am, that built up experience, that built up my body of work. And so I think it's just like you have a compelling story in that, of just continuously making decisions like that.
Yeah. And I think for, again, to just to, for your listeners, I think this notion too of, you know, like listen to yourself, trust yourself, right? Listen to your gut. And again, this kind of goes back to like, you know, a lot of your listeners are, you know, either hung up the uniform at some point, right? This notion of, right, like, again, strict emphasis on team and kind of graduating to that point of like, okay, I need to trust my gut. I need to trust myself and do what's best for myself. And sometimes that's going to mean going wildly out of balance. And sometimes that's going to mean like, nope, I need to take a step off the treadmill and do something different.
I love it. You know, I'm wanting to ask a question that delves into your experience, but realizing I don't have the knowledge to do it. But I'm just kind of curious, between the two of them, what do you see as like the biggest challenges facing our country right now, or our security right now, that whether someone listening goes into whatever career field, maybe it's something they can keep in their mind to try to find some way to help address?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I'm going to give you a nebulous and slightly self-serving answer.
Yeah.
In terms of the deaf perspective. Mm-hmm. So, but this really resonates with, you know, sort of the National Security Innovation Network kind of perspective as well. I think the greatest danger that we face is the certainty that we're going to know what the future will look like, which is to say, like, we can talk about game-changing fifth-generation technologies, and there are those out there for sure, right? Hypersonics, ballistic missile defense, quantum computing, all things that could, in their own right, fundamentally change the nature of warfare. I think, though, if you, you know, one of my favorite quotes is from Bob Gates, former Secretary of Defense, right? When he opined at one point that, you know, if you look at the long line of guesses that the United States has made with respect to the future security environment, you know, we've gotten it wrong 100% of the time. And so this idea that you have to build in kind of flexibility into our problem solving process, into our solution development, I think all of that leads to you have to have a community of problem solvers that looks a lot more heterogeneous than the current one does. I mean, let's face it. I mean, a lot of people inside the U.S. Department of Defense look just like me, mm-hmm. Right? And that's mildly problematic when you consider the total talent pool of 321 million Americans, right? And I think if you think about talent as this thing that's equally distributed against race and gender and geography, then the fact that the United States Department of Defense currently leverages only about 1% of the total talent pool available, that's a problem. It's a big problem, particularly if you accept that the future is so complex that accurately predicting what we will need to do technologically to meet it is going to be almost impossible. Mm. And so this notion of, like, you asked the question, right? Like, what's the biggest danger? I think it's how much money we're leaving on the table in terms of time and talent, and in terms of, I won't say leveraging because there's a utilitarian aspect to that word that I'm not excited about. But incorporating better intellectual diversity into our problem solving processes, like, we have to do that. Otherwise we will not be as secure as we need to be.
That's great. Two things that stood out to me on that is, first of all, a book I'll put in the show notes that I love. It's called The Wisdom of Crowds. And
I know it well.
Yeah, the author kind of starts with the story of a county fair where you're betting on the weight of this cow. And, you know, everyone, he assembled all of the bets at the end of it. And when he averaged them, they were more accurate than the one that won the overall prize. Right. And the sense was that given certain constraints, the wisdom of crowds is the best course. And so that kind of fits in with your thought of this diversity of both people and thinking as leading to the highest quality output. So that's one thing that stood out. And then I looked up a quote while you were talking. It was from Eisenhower, but he says, in preparing for battle, I have always found that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. I love that sense. You know, as I apply that to what you're saying, it's like, there's no way to predict the future. So of course there's amount of preparation, but I love what you're talking about of the allowance for the unknown, the flexibility to change. And I can see where Silicon Valley kind of pulls that into any sort of group exercises, the inherent acceptance of ambiguity and lack of certainty.
That's right.
And I think that, at least when I view myself coming from the military, I think that was the point in my life when I had the most certainty, when I was the most set on things. And I'm not saying that either is right or wrong, but I think that the blend of those two, of both certainty and uncertainty, can lead to a more flexible approach that can lead to a better overall solution.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I love the Eisenhower quote that you just pulled, right? Like, this notion that, like, you know, these things are not mutually exclusive. There are a lot of people in the defense innovation community, and I'll just be frank about it, on the younger end of the spectrum, who are like, you know, plans are nonsense, right? Like, a good strategic plan is only 6 months deep, and et cetera, right? And, like, I get it. But when you're talking about international relations and strategic deterrence, right, like, there's real planning that needs to take place. And we need to have a good beat on, we need to be able to place money, both literally and figuratively, on the things that we think are going to make a difference in the future. But to become so myopic to believe our own, you know, to make the cardinal sin of DC, right, and start believing our own PowerPoint slides, I think there's danger there. There's a lot of danger there. And we have to allow, as you said, for a certain level of flexibility and ambiguity. And we have to be, not just allow for it, we have to be comfortable with it. And that's kind of some of the work that DEF is about.
That's great. Just two last questions. One is, and for listeners, as always at beyondtheinformed.org, I'll add in the show notes for this episode links to everything we discussed. But in addition to DEF, what other resources would you recommend to listeners that have helped you in your career or in this career path? It could be books, podcasts, conferences, websites, whatever. Anything come to mind that you would encourage listeners to check out?
Oh yeah, good question. So there's like the obvious, which is like Lean Startup. You know, like that's like trite and cliche. But I think Eric Ries's treatment of the idea, and particularly the idea that innovation is not, right, like in fact, he specifically works against this in his book, that innovation is not this thing that you just do, right? Like it's not about just frenetic activity. It's about having a measured hypothesis and then testing that hypothesis and then making sure you're testing it against the users that you're trying to help. So Eric Ries's Lean Startup. I'd also say, I think it's Michael Watkins, though I could be getting the author wrong. First 90 Days, I think is a terrific book, number one, but I think the most insightful part of it that I think it's lost, honestly, a lot in translation, is he talks specifically about this STARS model for sort of business and CEO leadership, mm-hmm. Right? And having the right person at the right time in the right kind of environment, he puts a new context and lens on that that I think is just really powerful for incoming leaders. I'll leave it there.
Awesome. I always like to leave the last question open-ended, which is We've covered a lot of ground. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I feel like we should have had a beer in between us right now.
Absolutely.
What have we not covered that you want to make sure listeners know, or What are some parting thoughts you want to leave them with, even if you've spoken to it already?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, in the context of the interview and why I'm here, I mean, I think I want to say this about DEF. DEF is a big tent, right? I mean, we use the, people will understand the Burning Man reference for those who get it, right? But one of the ways that we open a lot of our events is by saying welcome home. And DEF is about a tribe, but it's a big tribe, and it allows for a lot of different perspectives and viewpoints. And so if you're looking for people who do two things, who want to see it and build a better world, and who don't just want to talk about it, but who want to like roll up their sleeves and get after building it, like the actual picking up of hammer, nails, and wood to construct it, like DEF is for you. Check us out on defenseentrepreneurs.org. That will include a long list of local meetups. And by the way, right, like, you know, not to get super sappy about it, but be the change you wish to see in the world, right? Like if there's not a local Agora near you, start one. I mean, join us, be part of it, and help us build out the tribe.
I love that. I love the proactive nature of it. And I love that visual too of picking up the nails and the wood and the hammer to go to town. I think that's a message that will resonate with a lot of listeners. And so for listeners, I'll have links to DEF and everything that we discussed in the show notes. But given the number of plates you have spinning, thank you for carving out the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, of course, Justin. I really appreciate it. Thanks for hosting me. Thanks again for the gracious invitation.
Well, thank you so much for listening and for supporting Beyond the Uniform. Beyond the Uniform is produced and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our staff is entirely part-time. They do this on nights and weekends out of the goodness of their hearts to give back to the military community. Our director of outreach is Steve Bain, who relentlessly books guests, finds sponsors, puts together our newsletter, and thousands of other critical tasks every single week, all behind the scenes to keep Beyond the Uniform running smoothly. Our editor is Kathleen Dillon, who listens to and transcribes every single episode to help out those who don't have the time to listen to the show. It has a major impact on our site's SEO value, which helps people find us through Google. Our data analytics and insights advisor is Andrew Woolridge, who pours over the data each and every month to help us better understand how to best serve the Beyond the Uniform audience. Our digital production work is done by Michael Cummings, who puts together custom artwork for every episode. If you're enjoying Beyond the Uniform, the best way to help us out is by telling your friends and fellow service members and veterans. iTunes reviews, believe it or not, have a big impact on getting the word out as well. So if you have a chance to leave a positive review, that is greatly appreciated. If you know of a business that would like to get their product or service in front of a military audience, we are always on the lookout for sponsors, which helps us subsidize the cost of putting this show together. And if you haven't yet signed up for our newsletter, you can do so at beyondtheuniform.io. We send out a newsletter twice a month, and it is a treasure trove of helpful information for your civilian career and transition. And be sure to check out our coaching program, where you can be connected with a subsidized professional, certified executive and career coach to help you in your career decision-making. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with more stories from military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.